Hey, welcome back to the Bill Bennett Show. It's the podcast that takes a deeper look at the news of the day, the current administration, helping you and me translate Trump. Joel Farkas, director of the American Strategy Group, will join us to discuss Wall Street and Main Street, the connection between the real world and the real world of markets. Also, Larry Kudlow, host of The Larry Kudlow Show, usually talks to you about economics and finance. He'll join me to talk about America's opioid problem. You'll be surprised how much he knows. But first, a few things on my mind. We've got, I don't want to take a lot of time, but a lot's going on in Washington and Trump administration. I got to address a number of these things, just even if quickly. First of all, of course, the headlines are the Florida shooting, the Parkland, Florida, the high school shooting. Debate's going on. Fine. Engage the debate. I was very taken with the story of Peter Wang, who's a student at the high school. He died helping students during the shooting, and he was in his uniform. He dreamt of attending West Point. He was in his junior ROTC uniform, holding a school door open so classmates and faculty could escape. 15 years old, and he was given posthumous admission to West Point, which was his dream. Always look for the silver lining here. Meanwhile, a lot of very passionate and zealous students are on the road to Tallahassee, to Washington. Their passion zeal is understandable. It does not constitute an argument. They should be listened to. Nevertheless, things need to be decided on their merits. And I got to say, I mean, I understand the perennial debate here about rifles and AR-15s and semi-automatics. But on this one, this is so glaring, these mistakes, these warning signs that were out everywhere. Claude, two calls to the FBI, one back when, and you could have said, well, that, you know, that was just one thing on the internet. Guy wants to be a school shooter. But then they had an alert in January from someone close to the shooter saying all sorts of things. And it was a classic tip, you know, see something, say something. And someone did, and the FBI got it and did nothing with it. Man, it doesn't do us much good when the system collapses like that. I want to say something else, which I understand to be based in fact, that when this occurred, a lot of the students at the moment, simultaneously, or shortly thereafter, guessed that it was this guy who had been thrown out. What does that establish? Why is that relevant? It means people knew this guy had a problem. Got to do something about these problems. Now, what's the issue there? The issue there is the system and mental health. I knew we had a period of deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill in the 80s. This was a big move to get people out of mental institutions. But I think we went too far. I didn't realize the numbers, but I did some research, Claude, and got the numbers. 1955, people, mental health patients in hospitals, used to be called insane asylums, but let's say hospitals and mentally ill. The number was at 558,000, which is a lot of people. How many people do you think are mentally ill in a country of 320 million? I think it's probably more than 558,000.
Yeah, sure. Right.
Especially if you think about those drug-induced and so right. on. Mm-hmm. Between 1955 and 1994, a number of mentally ill patients were discharged from state hospitals. If you started with 558,000, what do you think the number was that was discharged out of 558,000?
Wow. I'm assuming probably half of that.
487,000.
Whoa.
So 487,000, that lowered the number to 72,000 patients. The deinstitutionalization here. Now, this isn't the problem with this murderer, this young man. He was never in an institution.
Right.
But along with deinstitutionalization came the movement for non-institutionalization. The thresholds for committing people involuntarily got much higher. I'm a civil libertarian like everyone else, but I'll tell you, there's some people that shouldn't be just walking the street. And if you walk the streets of San Francisco or a lot of big cities elsewhere, there are people who should be in institutions. They'd be better off. They'd be better cared for. I think this is an issue that we need to revisit. This is not just, by the way, or even primarily a matter of federal law. It's a matter of state law. And I think this needs to be addressed. Address the gun issue, address this mental health issue. As another dimension, which is the school dimension, And my wife is very instructive to me on that. She's, of course, Elaine Bennett, the president director of the Best Friends Foundation. The day of the shooting, she was running a seminar, and you know it, Claude, because you work with Elaine,
right?
Called Stop the Silence, End the Violence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it means talk, to, you know, protect each other. If you see a danger issue, alert an adult, alert a teacher, stop the silence, end the violence. She was teaching this at the time. She also pointed out that in D.C., you tell me if this is correct, you've been in more of the schools lately than I have, there are metal detectors.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the D.C. public schools. Yep.
And it hasn't happened in D.C. public schools. Has it happened, has this kind of catastrophe occurred, slaughter occurred in any place that has metal detectors? I don't know.
It's a good question.
It's a good question. Take that up. Take up the question of the arming of some members of administrative staff, coaching staff, teaching staff. You know, an old issue of mine is getting former military into the schools. They know about guns. I do think, I know it's been thrown around too casually, but, you know, you're advertising in a way when you put up a sign outside of school that says gun-free zone. You're advertising to the guy who's got guns.
Right.
He's not
open
gonna,
season.
Yeah, open season. Yeah. He's not going to run into any opposition. Anyway, those are just some preliminary thoughts on that. A few other things. It would be an affectation today. Just heard the news today, the death of Billy Graham. You will hear a very moving and thoughtful account of recovery from drugs by Larry Kudlow, talking about recognizing our spiritual nature. No one spoke better to that spiritual nature more eloquently, or to more people, I gather.
Oh, goodness. Wow.
Billy Graham. You asked me before we got on air whether I'd ever met him, and the answer is yes. I was just in the cabinet, just became Secretary of Education when I ran into Don Hodel, who was my colleague in the cabinet, Secretary of Energy. And he said, by the way, I don't know if anybody told you, it was at the cabinet meeting. This was, you know, before I got in. But Billy Graham's going to be in the cabinet room for any cabinet members who are interested. I went and I expected, you know, 15 cabinet members. There were three of us. I believe it was Hodel, Ed Meese, and I, and Billy Graham, and got to talk to him, you know, virtually one-on-one. And what can I say? Very impressive. The witness, he was there. You know, he was a witness to everything he preached, and it was a very special occasion. I'll never forget it. Really, really great. May he rest in peace. No doubt he does. And talk about a welcome in heaven, you know. I don't know how much we can anthropomorphize these things, but talk about a homecoming, huh? The beat goes on the Russian thing. Collusion seems to be going bye-bye. Now the people who hate Trump are focusing on obstruction. But as a lot of these details about the Russian spending in the election come out, it's both, you know, scary in that they were able to penetrate and they're ongoing and they're doing this all the time, organizing rallies, but also how pitiful it was in so many places. Byron York had a great article pointing out that in some states the amount of money spent by the Russians was, as he has a column called A Non-Alarmist Reading of the Mueller Russia Indictment. I think we ought to put a link up to it. And he points out that in some states the Russian financing was, looking at key states, the total spent on ads targeting Wisconsin, financed by the Russians, was $1,979, according to Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Burr. And spending in Michigan was $823, and in Pennsylvania it was $300. And as Byron York puts it in his droll Byron York way, this is not the stuff of rigging elections. I would say that is true. We'll see. Phase two now, maybe. And it may be turning against the Democrats as they dig into this. We will wait. We will wait and see. Seeing pictures there, I see of Obama, the foursome: Obama, Brennan, Clapper, and Comey. You know, what did they know?
Right.
What were they talking about? And what did they know about Fusion GPS and all this? I think it's fascinating that, by the way, connected to this, the Flynn case where he, you know, is pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. The judge has reopened this case, saying he wants to see more evidence. He's not sure he's buying that. So all I can say is stay tuned. This thing is ongoing, and it is not over.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Bill Bennett Show. Okay, folks, joining me now is Joel Farkas. He's director of the American Strategy Group. Joel, thanks very much for coming back.
Thank you, Bill.
As I said in the intro to the show, I said that this my education in this area continues. This is a great unknown for me, all these things you're teaching me about the elites and the middle class and how attitudes and policies generated at the highest, quote, intellectual levels, close quote, can be really hurting the country. And that's just been very instructive to me. And I thank you. Let's jump in, because you wrote me a great memo, and I want to just follow pieces of it here. Wall Street and Main Street, the real world and the markets. We are celebrating this dramatic increase since the Trump ascendancy of the market, but also nervous about its fluctuations. But what does it mean to Main Street? What does Wall Street mean to Main Street?
What we hear and what we see and what we read is really a lot of information about what we call markets, but it's really the stock market. It's the U.S. economy, the world economy. And there's a lot of wonderful phrases that we hear about: consumer prices increasing, wage inflation, stagflation, the misery index. They all have some sort of meaning, and I'd like to explain what those mean. But what's most important is what your economy, the American citizen's economy, is. And that's very straightforward and very, very direct and very simple. The American citizen's economy, if they live in a major metropolitan area in the United States, is 50 to 75% of what each person or each family makes each month goes to housing, which leaves very little for anything else. That's the American economy that I'd like to focus on, in addition to all these other things you read about. But so that's the most important thing.
Say that again, 50 to 75%.
If you're an American citizen who lives in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C., places like that, you are going to pay, typically, in rent, 50 to 75% each month of what you make. And rent's not going to go down. And further,
wow,
if you're paying that in rent, most likely you'll never be able to afford to purchase a home.
Okay. What does that have to do with if I'm in New York and I know I got a son in New York and I know what he's paying for rent and I'm just calculating, yeah, I think you're right. And also sharing a small apartment with two other people. What does that have to do with what's going on up the street there in New York on Wall Street? What's the connection? Make the connection or the disconnect. What's the disconnect?
So we've seen in the last 30, 45 days vast market fluctuations. Why did the stock market fluctuate so much? Two significant reasons. One is it's all centered around one thing. The corporate costs are feared to be increasing. What are those corporate costs? Wages and the cost of capital. To put it simply, it's referred to as wage inflation. Wages for employees are going up. Interest rates are also ticking up. So the cost of borrowing for a company and the cost of employees have increased. Those are the two major reasons which has caused a fluctuation of stock prices. Let's take each one of them. Why is wages going up bad for Americans? Of course, it's not bad. We spent the last 8 years talking about stagnant wages and wages not keeping pace with the economy. Well, now they're going up, okay? Not so good necessarily for employers, very good for employees. What about cost of capital, interest rates? If interest rates were abnormally too low, almost 0%, 1%, what does that do to the value of the company? It's abnormally inflated. It's too high. So those two events are actually signals of something good happening to the economy. It causes a fluctuation of a stock market, but it also is a major benefit to an American citizen for the two reasons I just described. Their wages are better, and the values of businesses are more in line with what workers are getting. We've heard about income inequality. Well, that's really what I'm getting at. Income inequality becomes more equal when those two things are occurring, and they're occurring right now.
You mean there's less income inequality?
Less income inequality. Correct. Okay. Exactly.
Okay.
It's fairer. It's more in line with reality.
Okay. I want to be sure I'm following this. Like I said, this is all new forest for me. The president has celebrated, and his supporters have celebrated, and I as a supporter have celebrated, this roaring market since he's become president. Was I wrong to do that?
The market is one thing. The market is basically purchasing stocks of public companies. It's not bad. Public companies are wonderful. It's not the only thing that exists in the world. From a consumer standpoint, what does an American citizen care about? They should care about really three things. Work, workers, and wages. Work is a job. Workers are employees. Wages are what they make. Then in addition to that, they should care about what their costs are, what they spend. As a consumer price index, what are the major things in a consumer price index? Housing and energy. Two major components of what your costs are. If housing and energy are high, the CPI goes up. It goes up precipitously. If there's an abundance of housing and energy, it goes down. That's good. Now, is it bad to celebrate the increasing value of publicly traded companies? No, but there are private companies. There's small business. There's all kinds of other things other than a publicly traded company. So what we see is investors who are investing in public companies, they've made money investing in them. Well, guess what? If the stock market is fluctuating, they can move their investments to something else, and they can take a chance and a risk on something else other than a public company. Every day everyone wakes up in the morning, every single day, you have a choice to either buy a stock thinking it's going to go up, or you can think it's going to go down. There's nothing that changes that decision. It's something that literally can happen each and every day you wake up. Sometimes stocks go up, sometimes they go down. But as I'm describing, the most important thing for the American citizen, the middle class, people who are poor, who want to rise up, they're not owning a lot of publicly traded company stock. They are really focused on, as I described earlier, their economy, which right. is what they make and what they spend.
So that soaring stock market doesn't necessarily mean it's good for workers and work and wages.
It may be. It's interesting. A stock market that goes up or down, what some might deem to be bad for that, might be good for something else. It might be good temporarily for the workers. It might be good for alternative investments that are not stocks or bonds. Real estate could be one. Energy can be one. All kinds of different things. But the market, remember, the stock market is publicly traded stocks and bonds.
Okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's not mysterious. It's not mysterious.
Okay. Now, if work, workers, and wages is the point, and if Main Street, I'm just looking at a summary you sent me, instinctively seeks and seizes opportunity, it shouldn't pay much attention to intellectual economic critiques. What do you mean? What do you mean there? What are the economic critiques that shouldn't be paid attention to for the sake of work, workers, and wages?
The United States is still the most wonderful, dominant economy in the world, in the history of the world. The United States has, we talk about infrastructure, the United States has more than 135 million residential units in the country. Housing is infrastructure. It exists. The academics, these conceited academics who tell workers what they should do and how they should be paid in major metropolitan areas, what do they say? We need a guaranteed minimum wage. We need you. They have a whole list of things that is said to be needed to make things fairer for people in those cities. Well, a guaranteed minimum wage, whether it's $10, $15, $20 an hour, is not going to make up for the fact that your house costs hundreds of thousands of dollars more.
Okay.
It's not going to make up for that fact.
Okay.
So people need to understand that. What they're listening to as a solution does not help them.
Okay. Let me interrupt here because there's my question. I understand. It's not just what people make. Sorry, going slow here, Joe. Baby steps for baby feet, okay? It's not just what people make. It's what they pay for, right? I mean,
yes.
In the commonplace,
yes.
Back to New York, yeah, well, you know, my son's paying a ridiculous amount of rent. Well, he's got a good salary. Well, the response to everybody tell that is, well, you need a good salary to pay for the rent in New York, right? So, I mean, that's and that's that point. Now, what I need to know is how does the intellectual critique or the intellectual effect on policy affect what it is that people are paying for? I mean, you've explained, well, okay, they say, hey, raise the minimum wage at $20 an hour, fine. But if the price of rent and energy goes up, you know, more than that, I'm still way behind. What is it in the intellectual's approach that, if you will, I'm asking too simplistic a question, raises the rent and the energy price?
No, it's exactly the right question.
Okay. Okay.
Several policies you might hear about. And we mentioned, okay, guaranteed minimum wage. Okay. And we talked about that. L.A. County has a housing crisis. People are homeless. And people are some of the highest poverty rates and homelessness rates in the United States.
Right.
This month debating to put rent control on all the mobile homes in L.A. County.
I just marked that,
now,
yeah.
Rent control on mobile homes. That will not create one more house for someone who doesn't have one.
What does rent control on mobile homes mean? What does that mean? Tell me what that means.
If someone is renting a space, a mobile home space, for X dollars today, they can really never raise the rent beyond a certain index that is created by the county ordinance. So it just basically puts a cap and puts a cap on total rent and puts a cap on how rents can be raised.
Aren't we for that? We're not?
Well, if the issue is there's not enough housing for people to purchase or rent and live in,
okay.
By placing rent control, you've done two things. One is you have limited the people that are living there pay, but you've done absolutely nothing to create another housing unit.
Right.
Not one.
Of course.
You know, L.A. County has tens of millions of people in L.A. County. What about L.A. County saying, we are going to encourage, we want to build 100,000 more mobile home units in L.A. County over the next 10 years.
Right.
Add 100,000 more to the county of a county of tens of millions of people.
Why not? Okay, I'm for that. Why not?
They will never do that because there is municipal bigotry. That would mean they would be encouraging people who make more people to move and live in L.A. County who make less, whose house costs less than everybody else they're living next to. Where would you put these units? You'd put it next to people who do not want and will never support them living next to them. It won't happen. I've been watching this for my 35-year career, and I've never seen any person. I've been to more than 1,500 public hearings personally. I've never seen anyone stand up and say, I want someone who makes less than me, whose house costs less than mine, living next to me.
That's a classic statement. You've been to 1,500 public meetings. You've never heard someone stand up and say, I want someone who makes less than me build something that costs less than my house next to me.
Never. The one common thread I've gleaned, and I actually have gleaned absolutely nothing else other than that for more than 1,500 meetings. Now, that's almost every city in the United States and almost every city in the world. It's why I describe this as municipal bigotry. So a person who's a local official who's elected, they're not going to get reelected if they support what I just said. It's so much easier to say, you know, we're going to place rent control on this so people who are living there don't pay more rent. People who own the place can't charge more rent. Okay, makes you feel good. Do that. Go raise the minimum wage. Very interesting. Neither one of those things. Raising the minimum wage will make housing more affordable, and not building more will do nothing to increase the supply. Abundance in whether it's food, energy, or housing creates lower costs. And what does that mean? And I'm going to talk like an Ivy League economic professor. It means the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, stays stable. It does not increase. This is what instinctively American citizens already know. Most of them don't know what the CPI is or does, but they know if their food, housing, and energy costs are stable, they can afford it. And where can they afford it in the United States? They can afford it in Nashville, Tennessee. They can afford it in Chattanooga, San Antonio, Texas. There's 150 places in the United States right now where people can have a very good job and have very reasonable housing and energy costs. If I were in charge of economic development of these 150 cities I'm describing,
yeah,
I would send a letter to all the major metropolitan areas, to every single company that has fewer than 500 employees, maybe fewer than 200 employees, and say, would you like to, if you are able to pick up your business and operate from anywhere, I'd like you to come to my city. And you have 100 to 200 people that can now buy a house where they previously couldn't. And that you can, they can have a very good, the same work activity that you have, but you can get out of this place that, that has failed you. City government and the state government has failed you and your employees.
Sounds to me like what you want to do, let's make believe your housing czar and transplants are, okay? I don't mean organ transplants. I mean, you know, people getting up and moving.
Geographic transplants are.
That you would want the people who are struggling in L.A., New York, wherever, to get out, go to Nashville, and then let the gentrification continue, the young people with money to go into those cities. If you just have the young people with money go into those cities, that just makes the problem worse, right?
Without
an exit, without a fire escape for the others.
Yes. When you look at if you're not building new housing, you have no place else for someone to live. Housing is one of the things that we have so much data on. We know over the last 40 years, on new housing built, we know by price range, we have these graphs by price range, how many homes under 150,000 have been sold, how many homes under 300, how many under 500, how many under 700, how many over a million. We know what that looks like. To restate what instinctively is the obvious, there's virtually no new homes in the United States being built and sold less than $150,000 anymore. The percentage of homes being built and sold in the United States more than $400,000 or $500,000 has been increasing rapidly. So if that is the case, what in the world does it matter if you're controlling a rent or if you're trying to guarantee a minimum wage? You're never going to be able to buy one. However, those numbers are skewed by these major metropolitan areas. The rest of the United States has this like I mentioned before, we have 135 million places, housing units, places to live in the country. 130. I don't know of any other country that has that kind of infrastructure in place, ready to go. We do not need an executive order from the president. We don't need a new policy. It exists. We need to use that and let the American people use that infrastructure.
What about, let me come back to the mobile homes, just as an illustrative example, and back to your 1,500 meetings. Do you say as a function of, you know, the 1,500 meetings you've been to, no one wants to live next door to a house, someone who makes less and has a smaller house. If it makes sense to build 100,000 more mobile homes, if you're on the L.A. County Board of Supervisors, do you just mandate it?
Well,
it's against the will of the people.
What they do is they restrict it. So there's so many ways to restrict it. Number one, you mentioned earlier regentrification. Well, that's a hot topic in housing. You have areas that have had historically a certain population. People coming into those new areas, it's called regentrification. The people coming in are precluded from building something new, building something different, building something bigger, so building something more expensive. So in that case, you can't even go in most of these cities and build something bigger, nicer, and more expensive. You get the pushback. In other cases, you have what's called, you know, you have the historic preservationists. Well, we want to preserve the history, so we don't want this. This doesn't fit with our sense of place, is what's used, all the phrase used all the time. There's so many local zoning restrictions and opponents, what the NIMBYs and all these other kinds of acronyms.
Right.
There's so many of them. If you're an elected official who would say, I want to, like you said, I want to mandate this. Well, he's not going to be elected again. He or she is not going to be elected again. Number one. Number two, they probably can't legally do it.
Should they be able to do it?
I think it makes sense to build
100,000 mobile units, or it doesn't. I think you said it does.
I think it makes a lot of sense. I don't know exactly the data, but I doubt there has been a new mobile home park built in the state of California in the last 25 years. I don't know that specifically.
Okay.
I would be betting that it probably would not have been. Why? People view that in a pejorative term.
Yeah.
It's not good. It's bad. So does it make sense? of course it makes sense. It's very well-built housing, very affordable, very reasonable. The difference between, we're talking about, you know, mobile homes, which really is a manufactured home. That's really what the current phrase is today. The difference between that and some other home you buy. On a manufactured home, you own the home, and you typically lease the land. So it's a combination of how much money you're putting up. On another home, you know, you're buying the home and the land. Well, people will say, I don't like this idea of leasing the land. Well, you mentioned earlier, what are some of the other ideas coming up? Silicon Valley, Mark Zuckerberg and others in Silicon Valley have come up with another way of helping people to afford a home. They call it an equity sharing contract. What does that mean? Okay, you spend a bunch of money on a home, you can't afford the down payment. They're going to give you a bunch of money to make the down payment. Well, they're not going to give it to you. They're going to be your partner. So now they own part of the home with you. So if the home goes up, they get their money back plus part of the equity. That, again, does not create one more housing unit. What it does is it creates another financial vehicle for the Silicon Valley companies to participate in a homeowner's equity. Well, those are the kinds of ideas that the smart academics and the smart billionaire businessmen come up with. None of them help the American citizen. None of them help them create a more affordable situation. All it is rearranging deck chairs on a sinking boat and providing the other investors just another financial vehicle to participate. I want the focus to be on workers and wages and what they spend. That's what I think is my point to have Americans focus on, not the fluctuations of a public market.
Right, or not the fluctuations of a public market in some places. Because what you are still saying, leave L.A. and go to Nashville, right? I mean, it's a better deal for you, worker.
There's an existing infrastructure of cities all over the country that are a better deal for you. And the areas that consume all of the press are the media centers and the big metropolitan areas. Yeah. The solutions they propose are unhelpful, and their history has been to basically damage and frustrate and hurt the people that they're describing.
Okay.
They're bad policy.
All right, put a period on that and leave it there. It seems like we've talked for 10 minutes. We've actually talked for 30 minutes. You realize that?
I did not. I was just getting started.
I know you're just getting started, and I'm looking at the 5-page outline you got me, but we have other times and other chapters to continue this discussion. I'm telling you, I hope you don't mind this thread, but it's really contributing to my education, and no idea about these things. That's remarkable. Really, 1,500 meetings you've been to?
At least, maybe more.
Why do you go?
I bet
our audience would be curious. Why do you go? Your business is such that it requires it or recommends it.
My business has been focused on offering first-time home buyers the opportunity to buy a home.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires city council meetings, county commissioner meetings, homeowners association meetings, metropolitan district meetings, all kinds of historic preservation society meetings, everything that you can imagine that goes in. My interest and my passion has been to provide someone, a family, an opportunity to buy a home. And what's interesting is when I'm done doing that and they buy the home, any value that increases, they get, I don't. That's for another topic, but one of the great equalizers, the greatest equalizer of income inequality in the world is citizens of their countries owning a home. That is by far the best way.
Yeah. Well, you remind me of my partner, my ex-partner, Jack Kemp, home ownership, right?
Yes. We don't have policymakers like your partner any longer.
Yeah, home ownership, that's what he was all about. Joel, thank you. Sorry to cut you off, but this will continue, all right? Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Let me take a second to talk to you about your health. Brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day and important to your health. Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. Quip, that's the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of bulkier traditional electric brushes. and guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount of effortless. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's going in your gym bag or your carry-on. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. Find out for yourself why. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/bill right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/bill. GETQUIP.com/bill.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Let's change direction, folks. Let's focus on the growing opioid problem here in America. Joining us now is Larry Kudlow, host of the Larry Kudlow Show. Larry usually talks about other things, economics, finances, tax cuts. But he's here today to talk to us about something which he knows about and feels passionately about, and that's the opioid and drug crisis and epidemic. Larry, thanks so much for coming on and talking about this.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Appreciate it.
How does this stack up, this current situation with the cocaine problems of the 80s? It seems to me these numbers are staggering. A friend of ours, mutual friend John Walters, says this is the worst criminal enterprise in the history of the United States, the epidemic of fentanyl and heroin, 62,000 deaths a year. What is your perspective?
Well, it's hard to know whether it's worse than the coke epidemic. I've never really seen good numbers on the cocaine business,
but
it's certainly skyrocketing. And I mean, there are a lot of angles to this that are extremely troubling, but one of them is that the financing of opioids through Medicaid, which has been written about in a number of places. I like Alicia Finley of the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and she's been doing work. But Ron Johnson, who's the head of the Homeland Security, he's done work on this. So the numbers are skyrocketing. I can just say that. And I don't know how to compare with cocaine. I just don't know. I mean, I have an interest in this only as one individual who's been in recovery for, I'm coming up to 23 years, and I was kind of a hopeless abuser of alcohol and cocaine. I mean, my story's been out there for quite some time, but I look at this, and I still go to 12-step meetings, a lot of them, and, you know, I see the younger group, the kids coming in who may have started with marijuana. I think it's a gate opener, so do a lot of people. Some people disagree with that. But somehow they wind their way towards the opioids, which, you know, give you a high. And the numbers are quite significant. And although I don't hear this in the 12-step rooms, the work suggests that Medicaid is helping to finance this explosion. So more work has to be done on that.
How so? You mean that people using Medicaid to get drugs, to get Vicodin or other things? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, unscrupulous doctors and or unscrupulous pharmacists. The doctors will write a script, and the pharmacists will fill it. The script is, however, not only written by doctors, it's written by non-doctors. Now, we saw a little bit of this in the earlier periods of heavy drug use and heroin and so forth, but this one's really gotten really gotten off the ground. Medicaid beneficiaries can get hold of prescriptions for painkillers.
Right.
And those prescriptions for painkillers, whether they're real or not, given you pharmacy, the pharmacist is happy to fill it, especially certain individual pharmacists, because they know that Medicaid is going to finance these painkillers. There are very few standards around that. And then the opioids that are given to the patient, given to the beneficiary, the beneficiary then can sell that to a drug dealer.
Yeah.
who will then resell it on the street for three or four times the amount. I think that some action has to be taken there, or at least some additional, you know, investigation and discovery has to be taken to figure this out. But there's no question that the opioid epidemic seems to be worse in states that expanded Medicaid as part of Obamacare. That's all. Now, that's a loosey-goosey. That doesn't imply necessarily causation.
Right.
But nonetheless, nearly 80% of cases filed in Medicaid in Ohio topped the roll call of opioids. You know, that's Alicia Finley. And criminal cases have increased in a number of these states. So you can look for states, Bill, that raised the Medicaid funding, and you can also expect to find an increase in opioid use.
All right. Well, you raised the question of causation. You know, philosophy professor here, Aristotle, talks about final causes, efficient causes, and the like. I've been digging into this a lot lately. Larry, as you know, I was the first drug czar, first director of national drug policy in the midst of the cocaine problem. And this one is different. And it seems to me at this point, I think you're right about the Medicaid. And I think some of the efforts, some clumsy, some not, about testing Medicaid recipients on for drugs. Now, some of them may be legally prescribed, and they should have these drugs. It's a tricky business, but I think that's right in terms of where some people are getting them at first. What I've seen, however, is that in looking at the numbers, and I've looked at this not just nationally but state by state, is that the diversion problem, as they call it, you know, that what you were describing, getting a prescription either on Medicaid or someone else, and then it gets into the hands of the wrong people, either by handing it over or selling it to a dealer who then sells it to someone else, is as an efficient cause, as an immediate cause, diminishing now, and the problem is now more a problem of fentanyl and heroin. Not prescribed, but on the street. When I was in New Hampshire, just before the election, December of, 15, you know, the primaries up there, just before the primaries, all anybody could talk about was heroin, $2 a hit. So that, you know, the whole, let's leave the gateway question for a minute, because I do want to talk to you about that. But whatever it was, it was underselling, because at that price and the high you could get, a lot of people were just doing it that way. But back to my main source of information, medical examiner's reports. It's grisly reading, but death from, and it looks now like predominantly on these drug deaths, it is fentanyl and heroin.
Can I just say, basically, this is all synthetic heroin. That's really what this is.
Uh-huh, sure.
And it's a very similar high, apparently. I've never done it. And that's not difficult to create. I mean, you've got people producing this stuff illegally. You've got some producing it legally. But it's really synthetic heroin. And here's the...
Yeah, if you've had major surgery, you've probably had fentanyl. You know, I had major surgery 2 years ago, and I just asked the docs, a little fentanyl there? He said, oh, sure, knock you out, and then the painkiller, you had a tiny bit. Of course, it's clean fentanyl. It's supervised. It's, you know, the chain of custody isn't broken, unlike this stuff that comes out of Chinese factories.
That's right.
We don't know.
No, that's exactly right. And to get off this stuff, and again, I just speak from, I mean, I've done some reading like yourself, but I, because I watch some of these kids, it's really hard to get off this stuff.
Yeah.
It's just really hard. Now, you know, I first saw this many years ago when I entered 12-step rooms, whether it's AA or NA or CA or whatever, but you have to detox to get off this stuff. You have to detox for a while. Now, I don't know what all the medical procedures are, but you got to detox for a couple of weeks.
Detox means clean your system out, right? No, don't take anything. Yeah.
It means go without, and then various simple procedures to clean your system out. What's happened, though, is that sort of a second drug industry has developed where opioid problems are dealt with methadone, which was a heroin issue years ago, still is. And now they've added to that, I've just been reading this, I don't know what this stuff is, buprenorphine, naloxone, I've heard about naloxone.
Right.
But in order to apply those solutions, Bill, you have to first get off the opioid. That's a really hard thing to do. Really hard thing to do. So you have to detox, and you have to go to a detox center to do that. And there are things that can be used to help, but nonetheless, it's a tough thing to do. And my concern is, like, I moderated a discussion in Stamford, Connecticut, not too long ago. It was myself and two doctors. And their principal point was, and I was really kind of annoyed at them, is basically we've figured out ways to use methadone to get you off all these other things, right?
Yeah.
And I said to them, so that's the medical profession contribution. You're going to get off a drug by using a drug. Now, how do you get off the drug that is supposed to detox the drug? Well, we know it can be done safely. It can be done in clinics, this and that and this and that. And I said, well, yeah, but what are the causes here? Why are people doing this in the first place? Why does everybody want to get high? I mean, maybe the availability is better. Maybe the financing through Medicaid is better. I understand that. But what's in you, what's in the drug user that leaves them in this position? Because once you start, it's hell warmed over, Bill, to stop. I mean, it's just the hardest thing in the world. And I've seen this, as I say, in 12-step meetings with my own eyes. This is really hard. And my whole background in this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I went away to recovery for 5 months in Hazleton many years ago. It was 1995, actually. It's up in northern Minnesota. And, you know, they old-fashioned, they use Bill Wilson's, big book of AA. And it is basically a spiritually based recovery program.
Yeah.
And the medical profession, I'm not going to say the whole profession, but a lot of these superstar doctors just don't get that. They don't get that. They acknowledge it, but they don't argue it, push it, promote it, get yourself to a rehab center, but then get yourself into AA or Narcotics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous or whatever. And I think for me personally, the spiritual side was the key to stopping my drug use. It was the key. It was also the key to stopping my alcohol use.
Right.
And I don't know. You know, I think government programs don't emphasize this enough.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, Bill, Congress from time to time has actually voted on various insurance programs that might be federally funded or partially. And if you go into a program that uses the word God, G-O-D, they will turn you down.
Yeah.
That's part of our secularized society, et cetera, about which you have written eloquently down through the years. But that's a key point that I want to raise. I mean, it worked for me. At the end of the day, Bill Bennett, it was faith that got me through.
Yeah.
I mean, my life was dissipated. I was on my knees. I was in total surrender. Money, jobs, temporarily, my marriage, my friends, everything gone. And we had to borrow a lot of money to get me through Hazleton, by the by, which took us a couple of years to pay off. But the point is, it worked. And you got to have a change of mind. There's a word here that I never heard. I actually sort of did this in this debate with the two doctors. I said, you know, the problem's not chemicals. The problem is self. Self. You have to change yourself.
Yeah.
You have to change your thinking. You have to change your behavior. You have to be willing to take suggestions and directions from other sober people. You cannot make decisions alone. I mean, there's a whole litany of this stuff. You have to come clean. You have to cleanse your soul. You have to acknowledge your, in Catholic Church, I'm a Catholic convert. I know you're a super Catholic educator.
You have to
confess. You literally have to confess and go to people whom you've harmed. And this has a profound effect, at least it did for me. And I don't know, there's several million people out there. I'm not a hero. I'm just saying I'm one of many who survived by following this spiritually based program rather than getting drugs to get me off drugs.
Yeah, well, I think your testimony here is borne out by actually a lot of study and a lot of evidence. And it's this this terrible, reluctance to give any credence is the right word, to the spiritual and the spiritual nature of man that keeps public policy from recognizing this. But if you look at some of the most successful turnaround places, clinics, they're often ministries. Think about it. Marvin Olasky says, you know, what's going to be more effective? Some doc sitting across from you saying, here, trade this drug for that drug, which is your point, Larry. Or, you know, having the angel of the Lord get you on the back of the neck and say, you got to change. And then you change from the inside out. You know, regeneration comes from within. And I think that's borne out. At the end, it is a spiritual matter. What Jim Wilson, you remember James Q. Wilson said, you know, it destroys the mind and enslaves the soul. And I remember when I was drug czar, I used to say that, and they'd say, it destroys the mind. But they left out, always wanted to leave out the other part.
These faith-based programs, I mean, they teach a lot. And, you know, for example, with these heavy drugs, let me try to get this right. You have, first of all, your body has an allergy to them. That's pretty much everybody. I remember in the 80s, the New York Times was writing articles about how cocaine was a great party drug because it was not addictive. Nonsense. It became addictive, and I got hooked on that, and it's not easy to get off it. But point here is you have an allergy of the body. You have an obsession of the mind. All right, the obsession part is really, really what makes it difficult to get off these drugs. Your brain is just fixated on it and wants more and more. And then third, they say, and this is the part you're referring to that a lot of people forget, it is a sickness of the soul. And I don't know how that does in our society nowadays, which is a secularized society and doesn't believe. Although I will say, I notice faith-based spiritual healing programs in a lot of areas have cropped up in stories that I've read, like cancer and so forth.
Yeah.
But in any case, that's what they teach, and that's what I abide by.
Yeah.
So you have to really cure the soul. But to cure the soul, Bill, you know, you have to learn to make right decisions. You have to learn to change your behavior. And you have to have a strong amount of faith in God or some kind of higher power. It's not a religious teaching. It's a spiritual teaching. But you got to have faith. And faith includes not only your higher power, but faith includes, take me, okay, stubborn, self-reliant, self-centered guy. I was a big Wall Street, you know, master of the universe way back when.
Yeah.
So you tell me something, and I just wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it.
Yes, sir.
He said,
yes, sir. Sure.
Don't do this. I mean, it starts with not using alcohol or drugs, but it goes on to other decisions, other behaviors. And I learned this in treatment. That's why I helped Hazleton so much down through the years, because they persuaded me that, look, going to 12-step meetings, whatever your spiritual bent is, going to listening to sponsors, listening to people who have a record of sobriety, 5, 10, 15 years, I don't make decisions alone anymore. I haven't for a long time. I just don't make decisions. One of the things, just in a very pragmatic way, I guess 3 years ago, I was working at CNBC as a full-time host, anchor, and I was anchoring two shows for not quite 15 years, but one show every night at 7 o'clock. And then about half of that time, I was also anchoring the show between 11 a.m. and noon. And I couldn't do it. I was getting old. And I couldn't do it, and I was having all kinds of palpitations and whatnot. And I'd wake up in the morning already getting nervous because I had so much to do that day. So then I knocked out the daytime show, and I just focused for, I guess, 3 or 4 years on the evening show. And eventually, Bill, as I hit my mid-60s, even that became very, very hard to do for me. It just did. And I remember I would share about this in meetings, but I would go to my friends who were sober people, men, some of whom had really no idea about what I was doing for a living. And they would observe me, we would talk it through. And the conclusion was, and this was a bittersweet pill, Bill Bennett, the conclusion was, you can't do as much as you used to be able to do. So cut back.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to get into trouble. you're going to move toward a drink, not away from it. You're going to move toward a drug, not away from it.
Yeah.
You know what? After fighting it for about 2 years, I went up to my pal Mark Hoffman, who's the president of CNBC, and I said, Mark, I just can't do this anymore. I run out of gas. And so we made some, you know, arrangements. So I'm on as a contributor three or four times a week. Mm-hmm. That's a whole lot easier than preparing a one-hour show with five or six topics every night. And guess what? It worked.
Yeah.
The strain and the stress went down. My peers, my sober peers, were my best guide. And so I, as a matter of habit, if something's on my mind, I go and talk to people.
Yeah.
It's funny. That sounds fairly easy to a listener, perhaps, but you just have to change your behavior to do. You have to accept an opinion. As I say, it's a suggestion, but it's really a direction. You have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you know it. Your will and your life over to the direction and care of the God of your understanding. I mean, that's it sounds easy, but it's not. That's spiritual change. That's what it is.
This is really great, and I know this audience is listening with great interest, as I am, and you're being generous with your time, and given what you just said, I don't want to abuse your time and create palpitations, but either for you or for me, I look at my work way too. Anyway, but I got to ask you, because it's I think, so important to this discussion. Come back to the AA groups or the NA groups, the 12-step. Mm-hmm. Talk about the young people, and then tell me about this parallel debate going on the legalization of marijuana and how this fits in.
It drives me crazy.
It just drives me crazy too.
Because, look, I marijuana wasn't really my drug of choice, but all these kids who come into the room, and that's all I know, okay? I'm not a clinician, medical guy, but invariably, when you hear them tell their stories, there's marijuana at the front end of that story. Okay, now, is that conclusive clinical work? I don't know. All I know is what I see, you know, and inevitably, I'm telling you, it starts with marijuana. And the way they describe it is that then they went on and they were high, and they went on to use quote-unquote harder drugs. And now the stream of harder, I mean, typically it was cocaine or snorting this fired-up rock cocaine.
Yeah.
And might be heroin, or it might be synthetic uses of heroin. You know, I mean, there's a laundry list of these things. I mean, heroin is an opioid, obviously, and other opioids. Painkillers, a big part of the society today, because doctors prescribe painkillers very liberally. You know, it's funny, me myself, I've had just recently in the last year some brutal dental work, but I get the Novocaine shots, and then after that it's really brutal, but, you know, I basically, mm-hmm. I take three Aleves or three Advils a couple times a day, and after three or four days it goes away.
Yeah.
Okay? I don't want anything heavier.
I know.
I've had a back operation, I had a hip replacement years ago, and I told them. I gave my history, and so they were aware of it. And in a sense, your doctor becomes your higher power, or in my case, my wife becomes a higher power. But you just know what you can and cannot do. So, you want to legalize marijuana? Fine. You think you're going to pick up a lot of tax revenues to fund Lord knows what spending? Fine. But let me tell you, if you could hear these young kids come in and they want to get sober, they really do, and clean, you will see with great clarity how frequently marijuana enters that conversation. That's just, And fortunately, places like the New York Times and others are reporting on this, fortunately. It's completely different than it was 25, 30 years ago with cocaine. They've taken it seriously. Psychologists, psychiatrists, medical folks are now saying this. So that's the good news. The bad news is I got my party chairman in Connecticut, who's a very dear friend of mine, a public party chairman, who's come up with a great idea. Let's legalize marijuana and balance the state's budget. And I said to him, No, I have a certain clout in that state. I nearly ran for office a couple times. I said, no, I'm going to get out and speak against that.
Yeah.
All I'm going to do is wreck our youth. You're going to wreck the kids. They're moving out anyway, but you're going to wreck them. That's crazy. It's nuts.
Crazy. Yeah, I've been watching the Colorado thing very closely. I've been out there.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the docs, again, or not the docs, but medicine. That was the way in. That was the wedge. That was the smart wedge they used. Medical marijuana, you know. And,
yeah.
You know, because ease pain, you know, help people. Of course, there's other ways to do that, as you pointed out, with the three of leaves twice a day. But when they count up the revenues and, you know, other things, they're not counting everything. You know,
right.
And start to count those SAT scores in a couple of years. And I've been out there a lot watching it. And I'm talking to a lot of docs who are actually very helpful on this, which is, you know, this child psychiatrist I know who talked about the woman who came in, unsophisticated mom with her 11-year-old who was eating the candies, you know, the marijuana candies. And mm-hmm. She said, do you have any idea the harm this is doing? And the woman said, well, it's legal. People don't understand what legal means to a lot of people. It means approved. Okay, fine. Go ahead and do it. You know, it's a big obstacle to a lot of people when it's not legal. And a lot of sophisticated folks or pseudo-sophisticated folks don't appreciate that. But in your experience in the groups, this is what you mm-hmm. hear. This is what I hear, too. And it's not the argument that everybody who smokes marijuana is going to move on to something else. But when mm-hmm. people get into real trouble on a lot of things, including with marijuana, but other drugs as well. At the beginning of the story, almost always is marijuana.
Yeah. I mean, it could be painkillers for older folks
yeah,
who go through
right.
whatever they're
that's
going
right.
through.
That's right.
That's why this opioid thing.
Well, I think that's where it started. I think that's where a lot of this started, but I think it's now evolved into something else.
So if you read some of this stuff, you know, you can Google up a lot of interesting literature on opioids. One of the things I saw is that in order to use these anti-opioid drugs like methadone or naltrexone, or naloxone. Anyway, what they say is these drugs require full detoxification.
Yeah.
So initiating treatment is becoming more difficult. No, you just can't. Somebody just can't walk in and say I'm hooked on opioids three times a day, and then you know get some methadone or whatever, and just do that. Full detoxification. Now that's a very important threshold because what I would say is when you go through this detoxification period, try to find some place that will give you therapy, that will give you recovery treatment, and if you go there, try to find some place that will at least expose you to a spiritual dimension. Because you've got to detox. That takes several weeks. Use that period. If someone will do it, and it is a hell of a thing to do, difficult to tend to, but if you're going to detox, what about, you know, what do you do? Well, there's a lot of things you do, but you could expose them to some kind of spiritually backed program,
yeah.
fellowship.
Yeah.
Try it.
Yeah.
At least try
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all.
That's right.
So I go to Hazleton. And they basically, it's up in northern Minnesota. I'm basically locked up. I'm off the streets, you know? That's good. That's very good. So you get through this period of physical and mental obsession. But along the way, while I'm there, Bill, I'm actually, because I'm so desperate, my life is essentially over. I'm actually listening to what these counselors, and they're professionals with degrees, are telling me. They're actually walking me through the big book and the daily prayer and the daily meditations. And it doesn't always take, but for me, with God's grace, it did take.
Okay.
And so, you know, I've been practicing this for a long time. And that my point about opioids is if you're going to have a detox period, expose these poor people to some kind of spiritually based fellowship.
Sure.
You know, I look at these ads. You ever see these ads? You know, these really wealthy, expensive things where you can go to places that overlook the
sure.
Pacific Ocean and Malibu. And
sure.
They have them for executives now. You know, you can have
sure.
cell
sure.
phone, you can have your computer, but you'll be restful. That's just nonsense. You have to take
yeah.
all that out.
You got to remove. Yeah, separate. Yeah, goes the Lord made you, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's really, I'm just laughing because to me it's ludicrous. But anyway, I don't know.
All right. You do know. And instructive, thoughtful, and even inspiring. And
you were around when I was going through my
crash burn. I know.
And anyway, whatever. Great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
That's Larry Kudlow, host of The Larry Kudlow Show. Man, that's some testimony. That's just about it for this episode, folks. To catch up on previous episodes of the show, go to BillBennettShow.com. You can follow me on Twitter at William J. Bennett and like me on Facebook. Just search Bill Bennett. Feel free to email the show. I'd love to hear from you. It's BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. Please share the podcast with your family and friends. We'll catch up next week.